Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Oh, Yawnman Gander, that's me.
Ah, very nice.
This can be the intro. I'm Scott Tilford, you're Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Tilford.
Hello, this is The Wind Up, where we just wind each other up about stuff. And also, this is God of War Ragnarok's full balls out, smashing the balls, Yawnman Gander, whatever word I have, spoiler cast. I was going to go into a spoiler to finish that pun off.
Very good. Giant balls.
Giant balls. It's relating to the very end, which you'll know, people who are listening to this, if you've managed to edit the levels of your podcast while you're recording. And yeah, we thought we'd dive into all the spoilers because there's a lot to talk about. There's a lot of themes. There's a lot of different character developments, etc. And I have been dying for people to finish this game. Obviously, I called it the thumbnail when we did the initial review. I called it one of the riskiest sequels in years or something. We've talked loads about how, at least I think, it takes a long time to play its hand. And I want to get your just general thoughts on having finished it because we're going to dive into some specific stuff. But I've not actually recorded or talked to you about the thing that I absolutely love about it, even though it's kind of come up in bits and pieces. But I want to know what your thoughts are.
Which
overall
is nuts, right? We are coming off the back of recording three back-to-back God of War videos about Ragnarok, and we still have so much yet to talk about, which we're going to jump into on this podcast. Scott, I've been looking forward to this all week. I finished it like 2 days after we did the Monday podcast, and I have got my coffee. I have smashed the worst vegan sausage roll I've ever eaten just before this started recording.
I was going to say, but what did you have for lunch? But carry on.
Very nice. Yep. So my overall thoughts on God of War Ragnarok. Well, where to begin?
Ooh.
Well, here's the thing. It's one of my favorite games of the past few years. Mm-hmm, it's up there for me with the best PlayStation exclusives specifically. Yep. I love the thematic weight of its story. And ultimately, I do think it is head and shoulders above the quality of God of War 2018. If I had one room and I had the two games in front of me and I had one bullet and had to kill one, God of War 2018 would die every time because I think while it might not be as consistent in terms of its, you know, plotting, in terms of its characterization, it does drop the ball in a few things. Its highs are so high that I almost don't mind that. And we'll get into specifics soon. But overall, I think it's a big game. It's an ambitious game. It doesn't get everything right. But what it does get right resonates hard.
I think, yeah, it's one of those games where the more I play it, or I go back to it, because I'm going to do a whole other run. I bought the God of War controller, which arrived yesterday. It's very nice. And I'm going to do a whole other run through it and just mop every last bit of it up. But I've been doing a lot more side stuff. And I do love living in that world, especially in the end game. But yeah, I always find that like 2018's game, when I think about both of them, I think about 2018's as just more just incredible. The fact that they took this character that was known for one thing, just a giant rage emoji of a character, and then like rounded him out in such a fantastic way. And the thematic ground that they covered there was just so essential. We didn't realize that we knew we needed it. And Corey Barlog, the creative director of both games, has been on Twitter talking about how, you know, we know what stories are from books and movies and TV, and video game stories are kind of coming into their own now. And they want it to be part of something different or greater or whatever going forward. And I feel like, and I mentioned this in the review, but it wasn't with specifics, that God of War Ragnarok is this extension of what kind of started in 2018 as this medium advancing, medium elevating story that can only be done in video games. And by that, I think it's things that the likes of The Last of Us 2 and Red Dead Redemption 2 have tapped into, where you're living as a character for a huge amount of time and you're feeling specific things, and not just elation or fun or satisfaction through game mechanics, but sadness and grief and anger and like, oh my God, they're making me do this thing, and then channeling that as an intentional part on the dev side. And so to round that out to what Ragnarok does, I think the God of War Ragnarok is the best depiction of parenthood, or however you want to take that, in gaming or in maybe any medium so far, because of the active agency you have as a player, and because they play specific cards of You know, you're playing as Kratos, you're playing as the parent, you're playing as the guardian, looking after Atreus, who has his own agency and watching that agency develop, which fundamentally relies on what happened in 2018.
Yeah.
But they do all sorts of things where it's like, oh my, and they make you play as Atreus, so you see it from his point of view. They kind of Ellie and Abby it from Last of Us 2 a little bit. And just that general thing of playing the opening of the game, going, this isn't how it should be done, this isn't how I would handle it. Me as a player, as an older person, or I'm like 33, and also the way that I assume Kratos wants to handle things, but I have faith in the new generation, I have faith in the kid, and I want to trust them to let them do their own thing, and how far do you let that meet out? And I feel like the overall story is just about that, and the acceptance on behalf of the parent that's your kid will go and like fly the nest eventually, but how much do you put of yourself, do you put into them, and how much do you trust them to make their own mistakes? And like, yes, fire is hot, but should they actually get burned, and things like that. And by the time we get to the end, we'll just talk about whatever comes to mind as we go. That understanding on Kratos' part of, you know, Loki will go, but Atreus will stay. I still remember when I moved out, my mum's face when I closed the door on my own first place.
Yeah.
And her just having to accept that I'd moved out. And it's like the same thing of like Atreus has to leave and do his own thing. But there'll always be a part of that child, quote unquote, in the parent. And I think that they make that playable and interactive. And it's that quality that nothing else has done. And I don't know if anything else ever will.
I think you're right, man. Like, I fully agree that the thematics that you just delved into there are the game's biggest strength. And I also love how you get to see that played out across the whole game. And for me, it is those thematics that elevates it compared to 2018's game. For me, 2018's game is great, but it's about a character becoming human. It's about a character learning how to be a human.
Like a video game character becoming human.
100%. Yeah. And that is very valuable. That is offers great drama. But to me, God of War Ragnarok is about that character then living as a human. And living as a human is much harder. It's much more complicated. There are no right or wrong answers often. And you exist in this kind of weird space where you don't know if what you're doing is going to be the correct choice for you and the people you love, especially when you're a parent like Kratos is. Mm. Are you putting your kid on the right path? When, like you said, are you not trusting them enough? When are you letting them do too much? Like, how do you navigate these waters without losing them, without cutting ties with them and having them resent you? This game asks all of those questions, and that's kind of why I love it. I'll stop comparing to 2018's game after this point, but I keep coming back to one of the most talked about scenes in that game, and that's when Atreus kind of goes off the rails after he finds out that he's a god, and he goes very arrogant. He starts becoming filled with like hubris, and he's exuding this kind of elitism that he is now. Yeah, he is now bigger than humanity. He is bigger than everyone else, and they are puny compared to him.
Yes,
that's great dramatic mileage to get out of that situation, and it's really fun in that game.
So but relevant to the franchise as well.
100%. But to me, the philosophical questions that come from that aren't necessarily that complex, because ultimately, at the end of the day, the answer to the question of should my kid be allowed to think he's better than everyone else and start murdering people is a straight no. Whereas the questions about parenthood that the game asks in Ragnarok, like we were just talking there, at what point do you trust your child to, you know, trust their own instincts? And at one point do you let them fly the coop, as it were? Mm-hmm. There's no straight yes or no answer to any of those, and that's why I like thinking about them.
Yeah,
and it's why I'm excited for the rest of this podcast.
True. I will say that the depth that I got out of that relationship between Kratos and Atreus in 2018, when Atreus becomes a god in the same way that Kratos did in the original God of War 2, was that Kratos was forced to then deal with someone who was acting the way he was around other people. And the mileage you were saying, like, you know, the answer is obvious in that regard of, like, you know, you probably shouldn't go crazy and kill people. They answered that in God of War 2. Like, you know, Athena makes him really small and strips his powers away and stuff. But the mileage for me was that conversation on video game violence and giving into that level of action and being better than just slicing everything into tin and into ribbons because you can. And that was obviously what Kratos used to represent. He was like the tip of the spear for all that stuff. Like, if Mortal Kombat and Doom were that for the 90s, it was God of War for all of the 2000s.
Yeah.
And that was just such an interesting conversation on even the maturation of the medium. Like, it was, I felt like he was just such an embodiment of that conversation. And if he can be better, and if he can reflect on his past, and if his the rage meter in the old games, or like whatever the Spartan meter thing, can become an actual dealing with anger management thematic, then that's phenomenal. And I was like, that's all of that is a living embodiment of a commentary on video game history, at least to me. And I feel like even the fact that it was the same people responsible for all those games,
yeah,
having that conversation, that is almost nigh infinite depth on how far did we go in those old games, not just God of War, but in general, and how much we gave into those mentalities across different decades. So that was the mileage for me, just to like, that's what I loved about the 2018 one. That's why I can talk about that thing forever.
Oh, totally. And I fully agree with that reading of it as well. Mm. I'm just sort of, when I compare them, I'm comparing them specifically about what they have to say about parenthood, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
But obviously there's so much thematic depth.
It's like interesting because like even the fact of like having a conversation on parenthood, even Kratos wouldn't know how to have that conversation in the 2018 one.
Yeah.
So it's like they're building up to be able to have those conversations, which is obviously where they get to at the end of this one.
Oh man, well this is what I love. And we talked about it briefly in the podcast last Monday. Mm-hmm. However, we can now talk about it within the context of all the spoilers, which I'm excited about. And mm-hmm. it's what you mentioned there about the first 10 hours, maybe even more, of this game, you're saying, like, if these two characters just talked about their feelings, if they came together and discussed these issues, they would be on the same page. And people might get frustrated by that, but I was loving that drama because that is the point that they're making. That, you know, that is easier said than done. It is literally easier to say, oh, I should have talked to so-and-so about this issue that I had. Mm. But actually doing it, it's hard. And it leads people on divergent paths like this.
Yes. I'd say just super quickly, I've just realized as we're talking about this, that it's the reason that the beginning feels so off is that you're ostensibly playing a support character. Like, yeah, at the very beginning, Kratos is like jumped right into Atreus can lead the way. I'm going to assume he's ready, whatever. And it's like the Metal Gear Solid 2 thing, which like doesn't get talked about in a positive way that much. Of like, you play as Raiden to view Snake in a different light. That's what Kojima was always doing.
Yes.
Like making a greater hero from someone else's perspective. And it's not that Kratos views Atreus as a hero, but you're along for the ride in a way that you weren't in the original. You were leading the way in across 2018. Whereas in this one, he's like, I'm done. Atreus knows what to do.
Yeah.
I trust him. He's my son. Cool. And how that feels, and like the positives and the negatives of how that feels.
Absolutely, man. And just to kind of go back to what you were talking about previously about them finally having that conversation at the end and stuff. And what I love about that is that it takes them the whole game to get to that point, more or less. You get that great midsection where they reunite after Atreus goes to Asgard and they have to clean up his mess in Helheim, and they finally hug and Kratos says he's sorry. But it's a long road to get to that. And I like, for me, one of the most pivotal scenes in the game, or sections in the game, is when Kratos goes to create the God-killing spear to kill Heimdall. Because I love that as a parallel, right? This is a guy who can easily, very easily, go off on an adventure to find a mystical spear that should not exist.
Yeah.
Go to the bottom of the ocean to find a crazy mythological blacksmith to create this spear so he could kill a god. And to him, that journey, that act is easier than just sitting down with his kid and talking to him. And I love that, how they kind of like drive that home through gameplay. And when you get back and you've done this crazy thing without Atreus, and Atreus comes back and says, what's that spear? What have you been up to? And he still kind of doesn't want to open up. He's not even able to say why he did it, because at that point he doesn't want to talk about the prophecy. And I just love that those series of actions to Kratos and to a lot of people are way easier than sitting down and having a frank discussion about your own mortality. Because at that point, Kratos has seen the mural, Atreus has seen the mural, and none of them kind of want to acknowledge it directly, the fact that Kratos might die and probably will die one day and leave them alone. Like, that is too difficult, but going off and maybe just killing a god, that's easy for him.
That's another day at the office for Kratos.
Yeah.
I think the thing that's worth flagging as well is, because I think if you think of Kratos, as like, I think of him as like this big sort of oak tree, this big like ancient in terms of the amount of things he's been through, you know, staple of the environment, staple of a certain mentality, like he has all these different disciplines and everything. But he's almost like a suit of armor. He sort of cracks in different ways, and it's like he's this big stone statue thing. Very insert description for solid thing. But I love the little cracks in his armor, the cracks in his sort of general facade or whatever that you get on the side missions or just in exploration in general. That's one thing that's really worth pointing out, is that I would argue that maybe the best character writing isn't in the main story. It's not that things in the main story aren't incredible, but some of the stuff that a lot of people came here for, the Kratos and Atreus stuff, them just teaming up, you get the most most of that by doing the side stuff. Because if you just mainline, then that's Kratos by himself. That's a little bit of Kratos and Atreus. That's a lot of Atreus by himself. That's some of Kratos and Freya. Like, if you just want to spend time with Kratos and Atreus, you have to choose to do that and just mop up a lot of the side stuff. And they're all really good side missions.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, cracks in his armor, there's some really good bits of dialogue where there's one bit where, like, Atreus asks Kratos, like, about what was your training like when you were becoming a Spartan? And he's like, is that why you pushed me so hard? No, is that why you didn't push me so hard? And Kratos says, he's like, and Atreus says, do you not think I could take it? And Kratos just says, I didn't think you should have to.
Yeah.
And it's just little things like that where it's like he cares in his own way, like, which is such an old school phrase for a lot of, like, parenting and generational conversations of, like, they loved you in their own way.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that happens with a lot of advancement of those conversations is not just in their own way assumptive meanings of emotions, but, like, having to actually hugging your son, hugging your father, and, like, being able to, or parent, and being able to have those not necessarily right on the nose Mamiya conversations, but things that are a bit more obvious.
Go on to Mamiya for a second. I want to defend that moment where...
Sick of him.
I want to defend that moment again, because it's one of my favorite parts of the whole game, and I think kind of sums up my whole feelings on the theme of communication and miscommunication in this game. So it's the moment where you go to free the first Haufugas, I'm going to describe it as.
Big fish.
The big jellyfish thing. And all the way through that section, Atreus is very suspicious of why Kratos wants to do this in the first place. Because to him, it's very out of character for Kratos to agree to go on a mission that is altruistic, that is going to just exist not to get him a new spear, not to get him any treasure, but is going to help a being in need. Mm-hmm. And all the way through, Atreus is like, why are you doing this? Are you trying to impart a message that I just don't get yet? Like, what's going on? At the end of it, when you free the thing, he asks one more time, and that's when Mamiya finally cuts in and says the line, he just wants to spend time with you while he can, lad. And I know you don't like that, but what I love about that specifically, and specifically with Mamiya being the one to say that and explain it to Atreus, is that at that point in the game, which is quite early on, Kratos is not in a position to be that open with his kid. He's not in the position to be vulnerable. And I know that you said in last week's podcast, you kind of viewed that as Mamiya robbing the moment from Kratos. To me, I view it as Mamiya giving the moment to Kratos. Because in that situation specifically, I don't think Kratos would have ever said that on his own free will, on volition. At that point in the game. And that's why I loved it that he was kind of like trying to build those bridges between them so they can get to the point where Kratos' loving actions, which this was, can be communicated to Atreus through words, which he evidently needs. Like, you mentioned there about, you know, your parents viewing you when you left university. And obviously, I think everyone has
The house, I meant. Like, when I first moved out, yeah.
Well, there you go. I think a lot of people have a similar story about that. Because I remember when I first moved into university, so I was leaving the house for the first time. My dad hadn't really said much about it. I knew he cared about, like, why, like, me going, being the first of his children to leave home or whatever. I knew he probably cared. But I remember just as they were about to leave, after they kind of dropped my stuff off at the apartment that I was, like, living in, and he, like, gave me a hug, and he was, like, crying a little bit. And he didn't say anything. He didn't have to say, you know, oh, I love you, I'm going to miss you, or anything like that. And it was just in that moment where suddenly his actions sort of informed what he was feeling that I just wasn't picking up on before then, and I would have needed to have been told before then that he was going to miss me or something, because I wouldn't have got it through his actions, even though he was obviously trying to convey that with his whatever he was doing at the time. And I like that Kratos,
your granddad, leans in, he says he's just trying to take care of you, like, he's just letting you know.
Genuinely, I would have needed me mom to to say something like that, to be like, I would have been like, you know, like, why isn't my dad too bothered about this? And she would have needed to be like, no, he is, but he's not going to talk about it.
Right.
And then you only know that he feels that way because you see a crack in the armor, like you mentioned there. And I like that this game gets those moments right for me, that kind of the non-spoken intent behind these loving actions that to a kid isn't always visible. And you need that little bit more as a kid specifically to understand exactly how anyone feels about you.
Yeah, it's not that it doesn't serve a purpose. I just, for me, it was just like, I would have rather had Kratos like say something, or I don't know, I just would have rather had Kratos say something than Mimir in that specific instance, even though like, I get that like that scene worked more for you than me. I think that's good that like depending on what your parents' approach to affection was or what showing emotion or whatever, that it can work for different people in different ways. I mean, I didn't even hug my dad until I graduated.
Yeah.
And it was like, which isn't necessarily a sad thing. We were very close, but we just didn't hug. I mean, it's like that, I don't know if it's a generational thing. Like I said, I'm like 33. But I remember when I graduated and I did the ceremony and I was outside and I saw my parents again and we just all hugged and I got to hug my dad. It was like a one-on-one thing. And I remember thinking, I don't know if he even knows this, but I remember thinking, I've never hugged you before. Or been back when I was like 5 years old or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember thinking that was like a nice moment. In terms of Kratos Atreus stuff and like that whole crack in the armor thing, there's a great bit. The thing with having so much random dialogue in the side stuff is that you can tackle them in any order. Mm-hmm. So it's sometimes a bit hard to say like Kratos was here at this point in the story, because for me, I remember him being quite open about stuff, but I don't know if I did side stuff later than you or whatever. But there is a bit where you're just exploring, I forget which realm it's in, it might be Vanaheim, with Atreus. And Atreus is just saying, look, last time you fought Thor, you almost got killed. And to some people, you did get killed. Thor resurrects you if you die in the first fight. You know, there's no way you can overcome him. How can you possibly stand a chance next time? And Kratos says, next time I'll have you. And Atreus just kind of takes a minute and he's like, whoa. Mm. That's it, that's all you get. And I'm like, that's what I want from Kratos. There's really good, like, probably through a few writers' meetings, what's the most condensed way he can say this? They're more powerful for me than a support character spelling it out, for me personally.
Right.
Which is why I long for just Kratos opening up. Like, he's such a tome yes. of a person that anytime he remotely cracks open a little bit, I find it fascinating.
And I agree, man. And that longing for him to open up, I think, is intentional by the game. Like I said, that those first hours you're just begging them to talk. But what I just to circle back is what I love about the game fundamentally is that you have to wait until those conversations feel right for those characters, until they're in a position where they can have them. So to me, the longing is a point.
Yes.
And then when you finally do kind of crack into it properly with the reunion scene, then they are able to just, you know, have these conversations naturally without any awkwardness, without any worry. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of, their relationship is transformed from that point.
Well, that was the thing. So that, yeah, when I'm saying about all this random dialogue and Kratos opening, I don't mean that you can get it at the beginning of the game. Mm-hmm. I have to imagine that all of this, the more openness, even if it's through random dialogue, is all after the reunion scene. It kind of has to be. I'm pretty sure they railroad you until that point. You can do some side stuff, but those more open conversations must come after.
Yeah.
They certainly did for me or you. Yeah, that scene, I remember that whole opening bit, because I've talked before about how I really didn't like playing as Atreus. Not that the combat wasn't solid enough, but I just didn't want to play as him at that point. But I was, in the back of my mind, aware that they were doing something. This was a card they were playing. They were building up to something. And I was always curious what that was. And it ties in with the Red Dead stuff or the Last of Us 2 stuff, where like Red Dead 2 is intentionally super slow and super plodding because it's the Old West. It would be. That way of life is slow and plodding, and violence, you know, the whole depiction of violence and camaraderie and stuff, it works because everything else is a part of the greater whole.
Yeah.
And the whole time I was going through this opening bit of this game, I was just like, okay, what are you playing? You want me to kind of feel like this. You want me to miss Kratos. You want me to kind of yearn for his guidance in what we're supposed to be doing. And you kind of want me to be a bit aimless with Atreus and hoping for the best and trying these things. Where is this going? And it goes into the reunion. And the fact that they maxed that, they capped that off with the hug that they've never done before.
No.
Like he's put an arm over him or something, like on his shoulder to Kratos has to comfort Atreus. But when they finally hug, I mean, I love a hug in anything. Like I'm a big hugging man. I like a hug. And I like when characters hug and stuff. I just think it's like it is a literal embrace. You couldn't be closer to that person. I love it. And so like when they hugged as the payoff of, for me, 15 hours of preamble.
Yeah.
That was where it kicked off. And I was like, okay, this is what we're doing. It's about them learning they can invest in each other for a greater whole. And you get that trophy called Better Together. And not in that moment, you get it one of the boss fights later after you do that insane combo.
Yes.
Which is one of my other favorite things in the whole game, where they quick time event the idea of them teaming up, which you've done for some mini bosses, but not to that degree, where Kratos launches Atreus from his chains with a quick time event, and the two of you take them down, and Atreus also becomes a bear, and it's just everything, and they almost do like a slow motion stand there together thing.
Yes, they do.
And it says Better Together, and I was like, this is unbelievably on point.
100%.
So yeah, but it wouldn't work if they didn't quote unquote drag things out beforehand.
That's right. And to be honest, I do like that they drag things out quote unquote for the whole game. To me, it's important that a lot of the game player is supported by that Mimir line of he just wants to spend time with you, lad, while he can. Mm. Because the thing hanging over both of these characters for most of the game is the idea that if Ragnarok happens, Kratos will die, mm-hmm. and then Atreus will be left with no one. Both of them are reckoning with that. Mm-hmm. So I like the more lethargic pace of the game and how much it pushes you towards side missions because, like, metatextually, I want to spend more time with these characters and I want these characters to have more time with each other. So yeah, even though we should probably be focusing on what Odin's doing, maybe now is time to go explore a crater yeah. for 3 hours because you only get a finite amount of time with the people you love and you want to make the most of that rather than rushing to the end.
And they're letting you choose. Like, yeah. you know, you're embodying Kratos' mindset at that point, which is such an interesting, as of right now, I'm realizing that's an interesting comment on, you know, when can I, like, I'm like, okay, like this challenge is ahead of me. Maybe during the work day, I'll get all that stuff out the way and then I'll have my lunch break or whatever it is. And I'm prioritizing, like, let me get a full picture of what I'm dealing with and then I can do the other stuff that's more important to me. Whereas I feel like you're way better at going like, I'll get to that, but I'm going to have some food first or whatever it is.
I never used to be. But I am now.
Right. And yeah, it's just, that's interesting. That whole idea of like, when given the idea of playing as Kratos in God of War Ragnarok with a whole bunch of stuff to do, but a main thing to get to, I want to get the main thing done because then I can relax into the other things,
yeah.
which is my overall approach to like work or my overall approach to tasks in life because I'm loving all the endgame stuff that you do with Freya, even though I actively miss Atreus. We talk about that as well. But I love that they even let you play that mentality out. It's kind of like it's a push and pull in how much you think that's intentional. I'm going to go with it's intentional.
Yeah.
Because it's like it's up to you how much time you want to spend with Atreus in that moment. Whereas for me, when I was first going through it, I just wanted to know what I'm dealing with and what cards are you playing on the Ragnarok side and the prophecy side that I can actually get a hold of and control, and how much is it going to let me control them?
And I think it's a happy accident, probably, but maybe there's some intention behind it in that you don't know when you're going to switch to Atreus. You don't know when these characters are going to be split up. So even though Kratos doesn't die in the end, you're still playing through the game and completing side missions, knowing that it's some point they're going to be split up again or probably they're going to be split up again and that's why every time I got hold of Atreus and Kratos as companions I made sure I did as much side content as I could because you don't know when that is going to end. You don't know when your time is going to be up and I do think that that does play into the larger theme of, you know, mortality, spending time with people while you can and to develop what you were saying there from my own perspective. You know, I do think spending time with Atreus, just doing kind of side missions while the world's end is looming is important because it does drive the point home of, like, you can be so enamored with or so obsessed with the big picture that you miss the important stuff, which ultimately is the journey along the way. It's the time that you spend with people on the day to day today. Yes, stuff like your career is important. Yes, like the big picture can be important, but not to the detriment of the stuff that makes life worth living in the first place.
Yes.
And in this case, that's Kratos' relationship with his son. So the way I was playing it, I didn't want to rush towards Ragnarok because I'm rushing towards the end. I'm rushing towards never having these experiences with this kid again, or even worse, losing experiences because I didn't finish this side mission. And oh my God, now Brock's dead. What are we going to do about that?
That's one of the things that, yeah, so we come back to is that idea of they actively make you miss Atreus at the end. I think that's a great, like, creative risk, quote unquote, but I also think obviously it's intentional. They want you, if that whole idea of you're playing as a parent. So it's like, you should have that feeling of, like, it's like whenever you say to, like, one of your parents, like, oh, you know, I'm coming home at Christmas. Now, just stay an extra day or stay a bit longer. And you're like, do you want to come over today? Do you want to do this? And it's just that idea of, like, there is always going to be that longing. And I think that, like, and almost in a way, it's like any parents almost shouldn't be, like, super happy with, like, losing a part of themselves kind of thing or the kid forever kind of thing. They're always going to be happy for you to come back in whatever degree. And I think that the fact that they quote unquote gamified that is like fascinating. And by gamifying, I just mean you've put it into a video game and made us feel it. There is such a sense of longing at the end where it's not that I don't love the way Freya is depicted and everything, but I just missed Atreus so much that I'd actually made a separate save because I just kind of had a feeling that something will happen. And I'll not be able to get back to just before the end.
Yeah.
So that bit after they've made the reunion, it's right near the end, but one of the last goals that you have is like go to Tyr's temple to advance the story. And I was like, this is a good point for me to put a pin in time. Like Kratos and Atreus are on good footing together. If I want to make a save that'll let me mop everything up, it should be this point in time.
Yeah.
And so after I hit the credits and I was like, quote unquote, stuck with Freya, I mopped up all the stuff, all the little mini Asgard missions, because I thought they would trigger maybe Atreus came back and maybe you'd see him again. And so I did the Brock funeral. I did all the Asgard stuff. I wandered around. I met Thrud in Anaheim. Anaheim. Did all that stuff. Atreus didn't turn up. And I was like, I miss him too much. I'm loading my old save. If I'm going to spend time mopping everything up, I'll do it with Atreus because I want that dialogue. And then I went through all that stuff and I spent a whole day doing all the crater and doing all the, a lot of the side stuff with Atreus. And then I was like, cool. Like, I've checked in with my son. I've checked in with him. It's like when I go to see my parents every Sunday. Hi, mum and dad. If you listen to the podcast, you don't. But I went to, whenever I see them, and it's just like you've checked in. It's like that little thing that people do. You check in. You have your life, but you check in.
Yeah.
And I sort of did that with Atreus. It was on an old save. And then I was like, cool. I want to know what's next. And I went back to my Freya save. And then I did all the new dialogue. I went and met Tyr again, because you can go find Tyr in Niflheim. And I did that, and that felt more purposeful and propulsive. And like, that felt what I should be doing. And it's just like, I like that the game lets you like go back in time using the save system. And I think that's, even that is a great reality of video games.
Totally, man. And I do like what you were talking about there, that in the end game, you do miss him. I didn't really have a save that was up to date enough where I could come back and, you know, just jump back in with Atreus without losing a lot of progress. But it meant that when I was, you know, having adventures with Freya, who I do think is a great companion, it was kind of like, I was in my parents' headspace of thinking, oh, I would love to just phone Atreus up, ask him if he's coming back for the weekend. Can he come back for Friday night?
Yeah,
do you want
exactly.
to stop over? I want to see you, man. I missed you. You know what I mean? I know you're out living your life, but I've spent so much of my life with you
that
I want to spend more time with you. And I like that, like you said, you know, that can only really happen in
the
a
reality
video game
of parenthood.
Because you've played it. And yes, it is the reality of being a parent or even being a child in kind of realizing or kind of trying to negotiate the terms of, I know that if you had your way, you would have me live with you forever.
Yeah.
And that is totally fine, I understand it. But I've got to do my own thing.
Yeah,
how do
exactly.
we find a middle ground? And are you going to guilt me into staying an extra night, are you? Again, how do I not feel bad about that, Mom?
Yeah.
And I just, it got me, this game, considering it's about gods killing other gods and giant snakes in the end of the world and going back in time and giants and everything else, it is such a human story at heart.
Yes.
And I wasn't genuinely anticipating how much it was going to make me think about my own life, my friends' lives, my parents' lives, all of that stuff. Because, like I said, the drama in 2018's game was good, but it never got to that level to this extent, to the point
where
I was proper reminiscing, proper thinking about my own experiences in different ways. And that's just, the best fiction does that, I think.
Totally.
And the best games do that.
Yeah, well, that was the thing when I came out of, I guess for that, quickly for that point, I feel that 2018's God of War is like this open-ended conversation on video games and entertainment and violence in video games, kind of what Hotline Miami was like. You enjoy hurting other people, don't you? And then fleshing that out. And whereas this is like, because we've had that conversation almost as like a wider populace able to have these wider conversations, it is that more human conversation. Okay, we've established what, like, different things can be said about different depictions of violence in entertainment. What's next? What should we do next? And grounding ourselves and having those kind of conversations. But yeah, I feel like just that idea of like, where do you go with Kratos in this game, and like fleshing out the family side of it and making you think about grounding godhood and portrayals of masculinity and stuff is just super worthwhile. Which is, I was going to say we should talk about Thor and Odin as like presences in the story.
I was just about
to
ask if we could transition into those characters, because
they
obviously mirror Kratos and Atreus so much. They are fascinating characters in their own right, such great performances in my opinion. And yeah, I love how they kind of continue the commentary on what it means to be a parent and how different parenting styles can lead to different situations and whatnot. Thor as a character, I knew I was going to like him, but I didn't expect to relate to him so much. I like that he's this big mess who's had this, you know, incredibly dark past where he was a genocidal drunk for most part.
Also grew up abused by Odin.
Grew up abused by Odin, completely brainwashed by his father, you know, let two of his sons die and, you know, was really horrible to them, but then was trying to be better for Thrud and was trying to be better for Sif after coming to this realization that he needs to stop drinking, for one, and he needs to be a better man. Similar to how Atreus in Kratos get to the point where they both decide they need to be better, Kratos especially. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I love that characterization with Thor, and I love the performance by Ryan Hurst, I think it is.
I think so, rings a bell, yeah.
Yes, but specifically the scene that you get later on when you return to Asgard for the last time as Atreus before the final battle, and you have to go see Thor, because Thor has started drinking again. He's in the tavern because he's got all of these issues with his own dad, and he's blaming Atreus for driving a wedge between them. And you have this kind of like fun fight where Thor is drunk and he's smashing up the place. But then you get this like really tender scene between Thrud and Thor,
yep,
where she kind of says, like, she's talking to him as she would anyone, like any other person that she knew who wasn't her father. And she's saying, like, you need to be better. Like, I can't believe you've done this again. Mm-hmm. A really frank, a really raw conversation about addiction or alcoholism or whatever it is, whatever your vice is, whatever thing you have that is driving a wedge between people. And I love that she is incensed, and rightly incensed, by his actions. But then she ends the conversation being like, look, I don't have to like you in this moment, but we're here for you at the end of the day. Yeah. Like, we will help you through this, but realize that you're being a dick, and I'm going to call you out and being a dick, and you can't just make this right by saying sorry, but we'll be on this journey together. I thought that was, like, considering they don't get too much screen time in the game, that 5-minute sequence had so much depth to it that, again, it was a moment that got me thinking about my own relationships. And I was playing that section through with my girlfriend, and she felt incredibly seen at that time.
Right.
You know, having that conversation play out, and she was like, I've had that conversation. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, I've had that conversation. I've had a version of that conversation. Mm-hmm. And again, that's just a testament to the quality of the writing, that can come through in what is essentially a 5-minute sequence in a 37-hour game.
I think as well, like, it's that whole thing of if you're on the younger side of that exchange, like you're like the child trying to do something better for a parent or whatever, like whatever way you want to split that in terms of like younger, older mentalities, that whole underlying thing of like, yes, like love is there regardless of how like much I like the thing you're in the middle of right now. And sort of representing that in a video game, even though you don't like play it or anything, you are thrown into it. And I think that's really, really effective. It's also like a testament to how much you need to view God of War Ragnarok as holistic as possible and factor in all the random dialogue as much as possible, because there is a conversation that Mimir has. It's when you're just exploring Midgard, and they're just talking about Thor. Like, I think just Mimir is telling Atreus about Thor, and he just says that, like, yeah, when he was brought up, Odin would like physically abuse him, and like it didn't. Mimir refers to it, and I should know the exact quote, but I don't have the specific line. But he does say something about this broken version of manhood that gets passed down through generations, and it manifests in different ways. And you see it in Thor, like he's drinking his problems away. Which is something that, like, you know, many of us have seen in real life for people. Like, it happens. And that idea of the general mentality of, like, trying to be better can apply to various things, whether it's just, like, being more open or whatever. But I just think that tapping into that is such a worthwhile conversation. And the fact that it comes from a God of War game is something that the old God of Wars you would never have seen coming.
100%, man. Like, just, I didn't see it coming in this game. Like, like I said, like, the specific thing in that scene with Thor, specifically with Thrud, is, like, it's drinking, but it could be anything. Like, it got me thinking about my own relationship with my dad and his relationship with gambling, and it was like, okay, everything's coming kind of full circle, everything's coming out. And it was a conversation that was cathartic, because it was a conversation I wish I could have had with people in my life, if that makes sense. I wish I got to say those things to certain people, and how would our relationship have changed? Not necessarily referring to my dad, by the way. I'm not just slagging him off this whole podcast. But you know what I mean? Like, get you thinking about the relationship you have in your life, and how would you have wanted to say those things?
I think as well, et cetera. Totally, like, that side of it. Not to cut you off there, sorry. Just that side of it where, and I totally understand why someone who has maybe turned to alcoholism would think, this is only my problem. I'm just doing this, and this is how I deal with it, and I'm not being a burden to someone else, and I'll just internalize it this way and not have to burden anyone else with it. And then on the younger side, like, seeing that happen and being thrown into that and just kind of having to have those, like, really honest conversations with someone of, like, this is affecting me because we're noticing and we need to have these conversations. And, you know, and the support is here. Like, this isn't the way to deal with it. And, like, you know, you referenced, like, your dad and gambling and stuff, but it could be anything. It could be, like, mental health issues or whatever it is. And just being there for someone and making sure they know it and knowing that they're not being weak or whatever. I think we're getting there. I think all those conversations are happening across the board. I feel like even the likes of, we're not sponsored by BetterHelp. We might be, but maybe not right now on this podcast. We have been in the past, but even the likes of those services being more readily available, I think it's all a net positive. And the fact that those thematics are in here, I love to see. because I've been in the throod position before. And I think that that's a fascinating reality to see, depicted with such maturity in such a relatable way.
Yeah.
In terms of Odin, because you get, like, Odin's barely in this. I think that that's one of the things that, well, he is and he isn't.
It's like the paradox, isn't it? He's in it, but you don't know.
But not in his skin, not in his the way that you'd expect. They're not in the way that you see at the beginning. He is masquerading as Tyr the entire time. That's one of the biggest twists towards the end of the game. And in terms of Odin, I forget the name of the dude that they got, but it's a guy from the West Wing. Which I didn't even realize it was him, but then when I looked at the picture of the dude from the West Wing, I was like, oh, of course it's you. That is your face.
Yeah.
Like Deborah Ann Woll is Faye from Daredevil. And it is them. But Odin is there at the beginning and he turns up more at the end, but he's more of like a satellite kind of dude. Like he's in there when you're playing as Atreus, but he sort of represents, at least to me, this sort of dogged reliance on wanting more. And sometimes that comes through in a like an economic sense. I think sometimes that's a lot of the worst parts of capitalism, for example, even though like, whatever, there's a whole debate you can have on capitalism. But like, there's that whole thing of making the numbers go up, getting bigger and bigger and bigger, things that kill creativity or satisfaction, things that just get in the way of realizing what you have in front of you. And there's that bit at the end when the idea of, you know, Odin has been trying to see what's in this terror in reality for the whole longest time, and Atreus just snaps the mask, which means the whole tear goes away. And Atreus sort of says to Odin, look, you know, we'll spare you kind of thing. If you'll stop. And he says, I will never stop. I will never stop looking for something else. And I think for me, in that moment, I thought of all the out of control, ridiculous, global capitalistic realities of entertainment or you know, businesses, and not just, why have you always got to make the numbers go up? Why have you always got to get bigger? Why have you got to put more money into certain things? Why can't you be content with the families you have and the relationships you've built and what's right in front of you? And I thought of all that stuff. And I thought Odin kind of represented that to some degree, because he has a family, he has a realm, he has all these kingdoms, and he has all these people that he could help, but he's fascinated by getting bigger and doing more.
I love that read. It's not one that I had in the game, but it's one that I love. Mm. And I think you're right that you can definitely read that into it. And I think it's just like, it's a good scathing commentary on that, because
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, like one of the worst things in our society right now is that idea of being obsessed with growth for the sake of growth in terms of capital gains, in terms of money, in terms of whatever.
At the detriment of other humans.
I've mentioned it so many times, I'm going to mention it one more time right now. Like, the thing that broke my brain and completely changed my perspective on industry in general was the report that came out about Activision that Jason Schreier wrote a few years ago, I think it was Schreier, where it said, like, the state of Activision and Call of Duty specifically is bad. Because they are so successful. Because they are so successful with their franchise and they're making, like, you know, $1 billion in a weekend with each game. Mm-hmm. That doesn't give them the creative freedom or the kind of, you know, safety net to then go off and be creative and do what they want. Mm-hmm. It makes the goalposts even narrower because the next game has to outdo that. And totally. How the hell do you outdo something that is doing ridiculous? Like, yeah. Why can't we just be content? Like you were saying, why does everything have to grow mm-hmm. for the sake of growth?
Just to watch the numbers go up.
Just to watch the numbers go. Why can't we do great things with the insane success that we already have? And I think that is reflected in Odin when I think it might be Sif or Freya kind of says to him, like, why do you want this power? Why do you want to see into the tear? And he says, well, I want to make the realms better. If I know everything, I'll have all this power. I'll be able to make everything better. And they kind of rightly call him out and say, but you're in charge now. You have so much power now. Why can't you make things better with what you have? You're capable of making things worse.
Yeah, yeah.
Why can't you just commit to what you have instead of being in this pursuit of more mm-hmm. for more's sake and be good with what you have? When is enough mm-hmm. And like you said, with his final words, he kind of proves that even if he got this power, even that wouldn't be enough. He would be in the pursuit of the next thing mm-hmm. in that never-ending growth and kind of never being able to, like, take a breath, reflect, and then build what you have. It's always got to be in the pursuit of something at the detriment of everything else. All of his family members who he is failing with his actions. Mm-hmm. All of the realms that he is failing with his actions. So I love that you can read a lot into the arc, whether it's a personal thing mm-hmm. within your own life, whether it's you kind of pursuing a career, for instance, I know we keep going back to that, or pursuing wealth or fame or whatever at the detriment of everything else, mm-hmm. whether it's a more capitalistic comment on industry and business, kind of pursuing that growth at the detriment of the workers mm-hmm. who may be, like, literally the Midgard workers who are working for Odin in this game, you know, reflected in that sense. I think there's something really interesting about just that, his characterization.
Yeah, just that dogged pursuit of more and not really, like I said, being able to quantify or qualify what you have and that being more than enough and doing right by the people next to you and not always chasing something else.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think, you know, I'm not going to speak for you, Scott Telford, but I think after the pandemic, right, after we're in this kind of weird, not the pandemic obviously still going, but, you know, we're in this kind of thing where the society is getting back to quote-unquote normal.
I made a shrug because I feel that's the general noise of the pandemic right now. It's there, but it's not, and the masks are on for some people and they're not.
Let's say it's not really being, it's not being acknowledged, right, for instance, let's say that. And I think the kind of thing that a lot of people have decided in this kind of back to work, we've been through a pandemic ordeal, is that, like, what's the point of an extra few grand a year? Like, to some, obviously money is important, but when you get to, like, a certain thing, like, is it worth breaking your mental health over? Is it worth having no life over? You know what I mean? Like, if you're in a situation where you can, you know, you're able to kind of not take on so much for a little bit in return, like, would you do it? I think our parents' generation would say absolutely yes. Anything to climb the career ladder, everything to get to the next step of progress. But I think, I don't know, I think now it's kind of like, right, well, what do we have? Is it enough? Do I really need to make all of these sacrifices to get this tiny gain? I don't know. I mean, maybe that's because I'm speaking from a point of privilege where I can be in a situation where I'm not, you know, working necessarily from paycheck to paycheck. And I'm not talking about this in that context. I'm just talking about, you know, weighing up the pros and cons of the system is giving me very little in expecting me to sacrifice a lot. And I'm not willing to sacrifice that anymore.
I think definitely a lot of people have had a lot of just genuinely acknowledging their own mortality conversations coming out of the pandemic. It's like that whole thing of, like, putting up with a job because it's like, well, it's not killing me. It's like, well, now it could, kind of thing. Or you could just die tomorrow. So is this really what you want to be doing? And that changing a lot of, like, value sets and what's worth chasing and stuff. And then acknowledging the reality of, I'm working an extra shift, I'm working extra hours. What's this actually getting me other than I, in theory, look good in front of my boss that they don't even really acknowledge anyway? I'm not talking about specifically. Genuinely not at all. But I feel like that's a general thing that's been shared. And I've certainly had that in the past at previous jobs where you do extra hours hoping it means something and it doesn't. Whereas the thing that really means something is the family member waiting for you at home or the friends that you were going to go meet or spending some time by yourself and doing something that you actually care about and not just doing the thing for the extra few hours. For me, it's not that every single facet of that is in the Odin thing, but I think enough of it is in there of chasing the next thing and not just acknowledging the stuff that's in front of you. I think that's what he comes to represent across the whole story.
And I think specifically to Thor as well, like, look at what Thor got out of this situation. Thor did everything he said and he's still getting called a lazy drunk has been, you know what I mean? Like, I do think it reflects what we were just talking about there because, you know, you can do whatever Odin wants you to. And Odin will not care because he only cares about himself ultimately at the end of the day. And he might give you little rewards here and there, but you might also end up like Thor, who is like you know, completely just self-loathing in a situation where he's feeling he's letting his family down, mm-hmm. in that he can't, that he's too committed to this guy who is treating him like trash.
Well, that's another thing. Yeah, there's a whole bit when, I forget which character, either it's Atreus or Thrud, says to Odin, you know, the way you talk to Thor, like, I think it's Atreus, it's like, why do you do that? And Odin just says, like, oh, you know, you try anything else and see if you get through to him. It's just like, he's given up trying to parent or guide properly. And then, I'd imagine he hasn't seen the reality of Thor being in the tavern or whatever, drinking his problems away or dealing with his version of manhood or his version of whatever mold he thinks he's supposed to fit into. And that's like a fascinating thing in itself. Any particular thing you want to touch on next? I was going to talk about combat and how much they reuse stuff and things like that, but I don't mind doing more thematic stuff.
If we stick on the thematics for a sec, because we've been quite gushing, but there are things I don't necessarily like in this story that we've actually talked about in a video, but we'll flesh them out a little bit here. I guess before we jump into like the negative stuff, should we talk about the tier twist? And we're talking like pure plot.
Yeah, we can do.
Specifics, because I really like that, but same. I have some issues with it.
You should probably do your issues with it, because I thought it was like when it happened, I dropped my jaw and I was like, oh my God, that's like, didn't see that coming. That's really cool. At the time, like for most of the story, I was expecting Tyr to do more stuff anyway. I was kind of gutted that they didn't do the conversation with him and Kratos talking about being their respective mythologies god of war. I still think that's something that could still happen because the real Tyr is out there after the credits and you can find him and talk to him, but not about that. So I'm hoping they do that at some point, or maybe there's something you can trigger that's out there somewhere. But when he did that, I was like, okay, that almost retroactively gives him the agency in the story that I wanted, but not really in the way that I thought it would be. And I was like, that's kind of subversive in terms of the way that you advertised it and how much of a role Tyr plays in the 2018 one in terms of the things you find in Tyr's vault and everything. So there is that side of it where I would have had a bit more. I kind of wanted more Odin, like as Odin, to be honest, even though we just did about 15 minutes or whatever on Odin. And his stuff is fascinating. But yeah, I kind of wanted more Tyr. I kind of wanted, if you've got this wise person who's been to all the countries, all the realms rather, that to me is parallel to someone who's traveled a lot in their lives and who I can have a conversation with in real life about different cultures and different foods or whatever. I think that stuff is fascinating.
Yeah.
So I wanted that from Tyr.
Me too. But I do like that they rob you of it by making Odin Tyr the whole time. Like I thought that was one of the best twists in a game that I can remember recently, because I love how it gives you everything you need to know that this guy isn't who he says he is, but they explain them so well within the context of his imprisonment, how he's changed, that you don't question them too much. Mm. Like, there were times where I thought, there's definitely going to be more to you because you've spent too much in the background, and I know this writing team has something for you, but I didn't know what.
Right.
So when you get the reveal that it's been Odin, who has specifically been impersonating Tyr to kind of bastardize his legacy and make him out to be this coward, and completely piss all over the legacy that the real Tyr kind of established. Uh-huh. I loved that. And I think there's a line where Mimir says to Atreus, like, look, if Odin tells you snow is white, he's lying.
Right.
And I love how he mixes elements of the truth and elements of fiction with his version of Tyr to make you know that something's off, but not know why.
Right,
and then when they pull the trigger on the twist, you're in Atreus' shoes where you're thinking, if only I could have put two and two together and figured this out earlier. Mm. And I like that they addressed that, and I like even more that then Kratos says, oh, it was Mimir actually, says that, look, he fooled everyone. Like, it's not your fault. He's just really good at this. And yes, he gives you enough breadcrumbs to make it feel like it's your fault. Mm. But ultimately, he's played you like a damn fiddle. He played the characters. He played you. And I think even in that moment where he kind of walks off and Brock is saying, look, there's something off about you, I thought, wow, maybe he's a double agent. Maybe he's been working for Odin. Maybe he's been brainwashed. Even in that moment, didn't expect him to not be literally who he said he was.
No, and then I saw that in the subtitle first, because they reveal it. If you have the subtitles on, the name switches at the bottom first, and then because of the way that it's framed, you kind of, the camera pans up and you realize Odin's standing in the room with them. So I was like, that's a really cool reveal. In terms of the subversive stuff, like you referred to it as like a cowardly thing. I didn't necessarily take it as that. I took it as, like, at the time you were still thinking it's the real Tyr, and I liked it as a commentary on, you know, the Greek god of war, obviously Ares and then Kratos, is full on, let's deal with everything by cutting the living hell out of it, and that's how I get to a solution. I like that a different version of God of War has ultimately given up on war yes. and has chosen pacifism, or is a conscientious objector, or whatever you want to call it. I like that that was his choice, and he's just like, I am literally just never going to do this again, because that reflected the way that Kratos was becoming. And I'm like, yes, he's still built like an absolute tank, but like Kratos wants to settle down,
yeah.
and he hates the fact that Atreus wants to go to war, and that Atreus is asking him, you know, stop thinking like a general and stop thinking like a father and start thinking like a general. And Kratos snaps at that and just says no. And I really like that the end point of inaction is what Tyr is until that point when the twist comes off. And it's like, that's what inaction looks like, both to Atreus and Kratos. I think that stuff I really quite liked.
Oh, dude. Like,
for the most part.
Don't get me wrong. I think everything you just said there is spot on. And I think that's how the game hides the twist, because you want to believe in that new way that he's bringing to the table. You do want to believe that he has committed to this life and that ultimately it will work out. I say coward specifically, not because he's given up on war. Like, right. I'm not some warmonger over here. It's specific scenes that are off. For instance, when Atreus and Kratos meet up after he frees Gorm or whatever it is.
Sure.
The big wolf.
Yes.
And they're closing the tear outside.
Gorm, I think, yeah.
Afterwards, you see Tyr come out and he's holding a shield.
Yes.
And I thought that was strange, because it felt odd that Tyr would cower inside, even though he's already killed someone in the story. He kills a dark elf earlier on in self-defense. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was off. And also the idea that who he was killing were dead monsters anyway. It's not like he was killing people. He was killing the dead. And I thought that felt a little bit off and felt a little bit cowardly, the game actually addresses it, because they have the sit-down conversation with Mimir and who is Odin at the time, but Tyr. And Mimir says, like, look, man, like, come on, our home was under siege. Like, they were dead anyway.
Yeah.
Why were you grabbing a shield and hiding inside? And Mimir, as Odin, oh no, in Odin as Tyr, goes, yeah, you're right. You know what? Next time that happens, I won't do that. Mm. And I love how, when you have doubts like that, he has an explanation for it to kind of quell them.
Like, the writers knew that you might pick up
100%.
On that,
the writers knew. And then they get you back in, and they get you believing that this guy is the real Tyr. Maybe that was just a blip. Maybe he was just, you know, acting cowardly in that situation because he didn't know what to do, and he'll get better. Mm-hmm. Nope, it's all a big misdirection from Odin himself.
It does work.
Love that.
Yeah, it works massively, or majestically, or whatever. I think, I liked it as a subversive thing of, like, this guy on the Atreus side, because I just... Like, I liked it as, like, you know, you're putting all your faith in Tyr, and then he's not what you thought he was, and he's not the mythological version of him, or the fabled version of him, which in itself is relevant to the idea of living up to prophecy and living up to the roles that have been set forward for him, as, like, Loki, or where Kratos fits into the murals or whatever. I think everything folds in on everything else, which is why it's such a incredibly well-woven tapestry of a game. But yeah, that whole opening bit of, just to talk about, like, that idea of, like, Atreus is putting so much of himself in finding Tyr, and then that backfiring. And then, like, then Atreus takes on the sort of qualities that you have from the beginning of the 2018 one, where he just wants to get lost in hunting for a bit. Which we talked about in one of the other videos, of, like, the idea that that whole back bit is kind of weirdly paced. And we'll not necessarily reiterate that, but we can if you want. But in terms of the feel of those scenes, like, did you feel like that whole back bit was quite scattered? I thought it was, like, now that we're back together, another reunion for me happened about 15 hours in.
Yeah.
But then I had about 13 to 14 hours of just solid, let's just absolutely cane this stuff. And I quite like the propulsive, the absolute fire that they have as a new team. It's like, let's get stuff done with shared perspectives, like wisdom and impulsiveness in almost equal measure at that point.
Me too, but I do think it is almost too propulsive in its final hours. For me, as much as I love the Tyr twist, it's almost like the beginning of the end, literally, because Ragnarok is around the corner, but also it's where the story gets a little bit spotty for me, because after that, I do think plot points get a little bit rushed. You mentioned there the hunting scene, which we talked about, that I'll quickly reiterate. I think it does feel weird that after Brock dies, Kratos kind of says, look, me and you and Atreus, we're done with this, let's go back to our house. And they do, and then 5 minutes later he stops Atreus killing the deer, and he's like, actually, we should probably go back.
Yeah.
It felt like that needed a little bit of a breather. That's all I kind of wanted from the ending for these next few plot points that we go rapid fire through, whether it's going to Muspelheim to create Ragnarok itself, or whether it's Sif realizing that she actually wants Odin dead and that she is on Atreus' and Kratos' side. Like, all the plot points still ultimately work. We just get through them a little bit too fast, I think, and I would have liked to have seen them breathe a little bit more and be as developed as a lot of the early game stuff is.
The stuff with Surtur, like, there are a few things that just, they... There's a few things in this in terms of the overall writing of it that they, I'm just going to use the term MCU, they MCU it to get through it. Like you have Anga Boda just refer to anything she needs to do for the plot as just giant stuff.
Yeah.
And it's cute enough and it works, but like it's still just a bit like, I kind of wanted a bit more than that, because if you parallel it with how incredibly well they explain dwarven magic, which I think I absolutely love that whole thing. It's not the form, it's its nature.
Yeah.
And then in Freya, not Freya, but Freyr says that he had a suit of armor made from a set of quills from a bad or something, and it's just like that idea of it's not the shape of it but what they represent that you can tap into. And like that whole time across the entire opening of the entirety of 2018's game, we never knew how the dwarves worked or how they made stuff.
Yeah.
And it's that idea of like, can you combine the essence of something or tap into the essence of something? And it's literally, like I said, everything folds into everything else, a representation of Kratos. It's what's in between what you see that makes him up. And it's just, I absolutely love that so much. And I was like, that reminds me of the way that magic works in The Witcher, where it's like everything has a will to it.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, if someone dies at their wedding, then they'll come back because they died during the happiest day of their life. And they have some will there that can manifest as like an afterlife or something. And I just love the way that they explain dwarven magic. I thought that was really, really cool. But contrasted with MCUing things as just giant stuff, or the way that they do the Surtur thing, where it's almost like they recorded stuff beforehand of him pushing back and saying, look, I can't sacrifice my wife. I can't, take part in Ragnarok because I've been here all eternity and I want to be here with her because it's the only part of her that's left is her heart or whatever inside him, or her spirit or something. And then nothing really happens other than Kratos and Atreus go to leave because they're like, oh, well, we can't convince him.
Yeah.
And then they just have a scene where Surtur goes, are those the Blades of Chaos on your back? Because actually, I've got a thing that I can do that works with those blades, and then whatever, and then it just they almost MCU it. Like, yeah. his demeanor changes in that scene, and he almost becomes like the older MCU character who's just like, ah, whatever, it's time travel, ah, whatever, it's this thing. And I just feel like I don't want writers overall to lean on that of like a wink wink nod nod to the audience of like, we were gonna get here anyway, but we're just gonna jump there.
Right.
I prefer it more when it's like the dwarven thing where you make a point of explaining it properly.
Me too. And that kind of actually leads into the issue that I have with Sif's scene where she like kind of turns good, for lack of a better term, because that really stood out to me as one of the few actual missteps in the game. Not something that was just kind of like a little bit weird or not executed as well as it could, but like kind of bad. And there's very few things that this game does bad, in my opinion, and the Sif scene is one, because you get to this position where you're about to storm the walls of Asgard with Atreus and you run into Thrude, and you have this kind of back and forth where she's like, look, I'm not going to let you walk in there and fight my dad and kill my grandfather. Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And then Atreus is saying, look, Odin's a bad dude. He's put these Midgardians in our way to slow us down and make us like fight them and be in conflict and whatever. Mm-hmm. And she's saying, no, you would never do that. You would never do that. And as she's saying he would never do that, Sif literally comes off screen into the conversation out of nowhere with the Midgardian child randomly, that the one Midgardian child that you know.
Yeah.
And she goes, actually, Thrude, look at this guy. That's exactly what he was doing. And also, Odin's a bad guy. I've been saying this the whole time. Mm-hmm. We should go and take him out. And also, Atreus, I think you're all right now, even though the last time we spoke, I wanted you dead and my husband to kill you.
Very
Kratos,
true.
The guy who, you know, helped kill two of my children, I'm on your side now.
No worries, man.
It could work as a twist, and it still kind of does in the grand scheme of things if you don't think about it too hard, but just the way it's executed there, when I'm talking about breathing room, that's the kind of development that needed a little bit more time in the oven, needed to be presented in a little... In a different way, because it didn't work for me.
I do remember, I remember thinking that's the thing. If you have an ensemble cast where everyone is kind of, they're not overacting, but they're like, everyone is memorable. Everyone either has a visually distinct thing or they're acted in a certain way. And then it's like, the gang's all here. It's like, it is like a big ensemble finish, which is very in right now. Again, Marvel popularized that. And it's not like, ever since the Avengers, and it's not like the end of Ragnarok the game. It's very much like the end of a Marvel movie. It feels a lot like the final fight in Endgame.
Yeah.
Down to like, you know, flying creatures in the background and everything. But it kind of ties in with, I don't know if you want to talk about this that much, but like the way the camera work is in this, because that reveal of like Sif walks in into frame.
Yes.
You were saying like, you know, going forward, we did a whole bunch of videos on what might happen going forward. That idea of, you know, should they ditch the one take camera, because it leads to things things like this that are, you can't really shoot them any other way if you're sticking to one camera that's here.
I think they should ditch the one-shot gimmick after this game because I think it's been an incredible experiment. The first game executed very well, and this moment even elevates it in some sections. Like the transition between Kratos and Atreus sometimes when he's in Asgard and Kratos is in the realms between, like they're done so well. Yep. I think this one-shot camera perspective is so great for accentuating the character moments, the emotion on someone's faces, putting you in the headspace of someone. It's not good at all for visual storytelling on a grand scale, though. I don't think it's very good at scale. And when you get to those final sections when you're storming Asgard, it's just not the right type of visual storytelling, in my opinion, because it's it's often kind of even illegible. Like the moment where you get to the Midgardians didn't sell for me because I could barely see what was going on. I couldn't tell visually that people were in danger and Ragnarok was coming to kill them specifically. Like it was only until Atreus said and spelled it out that I fully understood what was going on in that section. And it's like, if you shot that different, you could convey the same information with more impact through visuals. But the confining nature of the camera just means that you don't quite get that in terms of that broader strokes storytelling. So it's been a great experiment. I do think it's worked overall for these two games, but I would like to see a change in style for whatever comes next personally.
No, I can back that. I think that like one thing that I really like, because I don't necessarily want them to ditch it. I need them to figure out ways of trying to find some innovative way of filming those scenes or shooting those scenes, whatever you want to call it, in a new way. Because I really liked the, I like the fact that if you literally play 2018 and Ragnarok back to back, it's one giant take for that entire game. Although I don't like that when you go into the magic gate thing, you get a whiteout. Because I'm like, that would be a cut in a movie.
Yeah.
You could have hidden a cut there, quote unquote, if it was like a movie. But the vast majority is like one take. And I like that it is always Kratos and Atreus' perspective. I think if they did a thing, if they do another game, which Corey said that they're doing something else that seems to involve Jormungandr in some degree, go watch the video. Then maybe they like detach the camera then, because maybe that's what we're building to. The idea of the camera focused on one person throughout the first game, Kratos' perspective, and then in Ragnarok, it starts to split and it shows you Kratos and Atreus. And then when there's full agency in the world of maybe we're following someone else entirely, or maybe Atreus meets someone or whatever we do, maybe then we start having, we bring cuts in.
Yeah.
And maybe they make that a story element where something happens in the game that like, you know, shakes the camera so much that, I don't know, then we split and we follow other things. I don't know. I feel like they could do something cool with it.
Yeah.
And try and tie it in, because it feels like the camera is almost you. It's a separate character in itself, even though it's not an actual body.
That's true. I guess they could keep it. I just want to see what you were saying there, kind of like more variety in terms of what you can show. Don't make it just tied to one character. Maybe like I want to see more wide shots, like for two games that are this grand in the terms of their storytelling, in terms of the mythology you're looking at. Like I need more wides.
Jormungandr versus Thor, guys. And you can't even see it.
100%. Like, yeah, I need other things to be the focal point. I need you to shoot things in a more cinematic style in terms of the action set pieces. There was just times, and maybe this is intentional, during the assault on Asgard in particular, where I was craving a God of War 3 style cameraman.
Yes.
I wanted to run up a big monster.
Zoom
all the way out. I wanted to see the action, because whilst it's intentional that you're in this kind of claustrophobic camera for the most part, I do think it jars, not in a good way, when you get to those big battle scenes, because there's no intent there, I don't think. Well, there's intent, but it doesn't pay off.
I think it's because they went so overboard with that stuff in God of War Ascension. Like, it was just like, Ascension was always the unwanted one anyway. It was the one where everyone got too sick of the gore and a lot of the marketing before it was released. It was the one that had multiplayer. It was just the one that people just didn't want. And it's very much like a Gaiden side story anyway. But that game, especially at the beginning, has tons of let's zoom out and show you what's going on stuff, to a point where you can't even see what's going on. You are a tiny little like mess of pixels being Kratos, but you still have full control. You're still taking damage, and it's still just like, okay, you've gone too far. Like, this is, you've committed to this too much. In the new one, I wonder if they just don't do it because the combat model would be weird if you disconnected the camera that much. If it zoomed all the way out and you retained control.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a middle ground, because they do quick time events in this. There are really cool ones where you take down dragons, or you're like punching one of those earth elementals in the chest over and over again. And they just switch to a quick time event. But
I don't know whether it's a creative choice, or if it's a limitation of the tech. Because when you go to the crater in Vanaheim, for instance, one of the best areas in
the
game,
best area of the year.
100%. Yeah. I think that's so striking because about how open it is from the minute you get there. You see the entire landscape and it's flat and it doesn't look like a corridor like a lot of the areas in the other realms do. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like I said, I don't know whether that was a design thing, whether they could have done that for every realm, or whether it is a technical limitation of the PlayStation 4 not being able to render so much detail at the same time. Or
is
the
it
engine.
Maybe what was originally God of War 3? And
maybe
then put into two.
That's it. Like I really don't know, but I would like to see more expanses. I would like to see it become less claustrophobic because I think it worked here, but I want to go back to a little bit more variety in the camera work. Mm. That said, I do think there is one instance particularly where the claustrophobic camera work works really well, if you'll permit me to move on.
I will always permit you to move on.
And that's when you have the fight with Heimdall, which is so good as Kratos.
Yes.
You kill Heimdall. That is one of my favorite parts of the game because I think he is a particularly great antagonist.
Yeah.
The game makes you hate him so much. The section where he's bullying Atreus and he's beating up Thrude, it's like you are a piece of trash.
Yep.
I love the hand that the game plays by making you want him dead.
Right.
You want him dead so much, even though you know that's going to kickstart Ragnarok. And it's like, man, I have the bloodlust that Kratos feels.
Yeah.
And I want to get the catharsis of seeing you die, even though I know the consequences. And I like how that's the moment where they also make Kratos appear to be the closest to his God of War 2 or 3 self.
Mm.
And you even get the parallel with him strangling Heimdall like he strangled, if I recall.
Zeus.
Well,
Zeus was like an in-the-eyes thing.
That's in the eyes. Yeah. But he strangled gods before is the point. It's up close and personal. It's like he is doing this again. He is reverting back to type.
And also, like, the act of strangling someone is one of the most primal things you could go
100%.
For. Like, it's not. There's no elegance in it. There's no, like, real discipline to it. He certainly wasn't taught that in Spartan school.
100%.
It's just like it's a full-on emotional reaction to, this is the guy that's going to kill my son, and I'm going to absolutely make sure that doesn't happen.
That's it. And I like that, you know, all the way throughout that section, or at least for me, I was secretly hoping to see the old Kratos come out, even though I knew that would be detrimental to the entire world. And I almost think it's intentional in how Heimdall is presented to support the idea that, you know, this feels like history repeating itself in Kratos, because I do think that Heimdall as a character feels completely different from the other gods that you come across and is created in the vein of older God of War gods. Mm-hmm. He is very reminiscent for me of Hermes from the original trilogy. He's a god who is flashy, he is arrogant, he is powerful, and he is totally fine with flexing those powers in a way that I don't think Thor or Odin really are. Like, they are not that callous. Like, they can be cruel, but they don't. Like,
well, they bargain with Kratos at the very beginning.
100%, 100%. The gods in the previous games would not do that. They would come in and try to kill him, you know what I mean?
They would blow the whole house away and then be like, you stay there.
Absolutely, and I think Heimdall is cut from that same cloth intentionally, because in that moment, it's feeling like an older God of War game. You're getting this rage out of Kratos. Mm. He is being reckless. He wants the bloodlust to come to the fore despite the consequences. In the previous games, he's literally tanked all of Greece through that bloodlust. And here, there's a threat that he might tank all of Norse mythology as well. And he manages to rein it in the end, but you get flashes of it. And I just love that confrontation.
There was a great point from, because I love, in that regard, I love in 2018's one when he goes down to Helheim, might be Niflheim, one of the two. They're almost the same realm.
Yeah.
Sorry, Helheim and Niflheimians, but it's almost the same thing. And when he has to retrieve the Blades of Chaos to go down there, and then he kills that big creature, and they have that great moment. Its camera work's really good too, where they slowly zoom out from him. Starts really tight and zooms out, but he realizes that he has become the old him. He has the blades and he's just killing something and he has to go into the guts of it to retrieve something.
Yeah.
I think because they did that, he almost can't let himself go there again. But there's a great point, I should know the dude's name, but it's in the most recent PlayStation video on the game. It's called, because the original documentary was called Raising Kratos. I think this one's called Becoming Kratos. And you have all the different Kratos voice actors. Chris Judge, obviously, for the Western release, and various other ones for around the world, which is great. I love the idea of hearing Japanese Kratos.
Yes.
It's so cool. Stuff like that's really, really awesome. However, they also have, or as well as, they also have The dude that does the motion capture for the various moves the Kratos has. And that guy says that the when he does like a big arcing swing, like from almost like on a clock, it's like 2 o'clock to 8 o'clock kind of thing, or 10 till four or whatever, he starts in a disciplined place and he ends in a disciplined place, but there's so much swing in the middle where that's the Kratos fury.
Right.
And he lets himself go when he does that. And he's like, that's what we motion captured, is like when Kratos is like fully swinging, fully shouting and everything, that's the old Kratos, but he comes back and he retrains it. And it's every one of those big swings is that mix of the old and the new him. And I think that's an incredible way to think about it, because the combat does have so much viscerality to it. And I absolutely love, just as an old school God of War mentality, that when you beat like a berserker or anything that's just causing you an annoyance, you will absolutely kick the living S out of it, or whatever, just being nice because we're on their podcast, kick the living hell out of it. And even just beheading a berserker or cutting them, like cleaving them so their head and arm both comes off. I'm like, yeah, you deserve that for putting me through the last half an hour of trial and error. And I love that Kratos can have that and then just can redeem himself. Can recompose himself.
Yeah.
And then just chat again with whoever's next to him, because he's harnessed both sides of it. I think that in itself is the evolution of him.
I did not know that, but I like that a lot. And I do like thematically that he does always come back around to being better. He might lose himself or have a little bit of a wobbly here and there. But even in the Heimdall fight, like, he loses himself, but at least he loses himself for the right reasons at that point. He doesn't just go straight to the murder. He gives Heimdall a chance. He blows off his arm. He says, like, stop it. Like, you need to be better. And it's only when Heimdall says no. It's similar to Atreus and Odin, where Odin says, like, I would never stop. Heimdall essentially says, listen, I'm never going to stop hunting you. You're going to have to put me down.
Yeah.
And it's only until Kratos has no choice that then he murders him dead.
Which is almost like the runaway, endless version of pride, where, like, nothing can really satisfy pride, and he's been wounded, his ego's been wounded, so Heimdall will always chase him down to try and make right. I think as well, as like a final point on the violent stuff as well, like that whole thing of, like, you know, losing yourself and recomposure and choosing when to use violence. I think that in itself is evident in gaming. You very rarely get games that are gore-first now, like Mortal Kombat, like Doom. I mean, that's one of my favorite games of all time. I love gore in games. Like, give me that left, right, and center. But I feel like in more mature works or bigger blockbusters or whatever, there has to be more of a justification for why overblown violence is used, and that can be really, really effective. And I feel like a lot of the bigger titles in the industry have learned that, and I feel like they have a better utilization of violence and gore. It comes alongside other things. It can't just be over the top for the sake of it, like old school Mortal Kombat or like Carmageddon or like that Hatred game from like 2017 or whatever. I feel like that in itself is a like living evolution of the conversation God of War started in 2018.
Yeah, I think I love totally it. Right. Especially like just with the idea of like, justifying that violence and like, why do we want to see it? There are games where, you know, there are God of War games where it's like, we can just pretend this is, you know, has no real consequence. It's just fun. It's just a power trip. Mm. But what happens when we contextualize it in a game like this where we are commenting about violence? We can't just slip back into old habits, because we've established now that that has consequences and bad things happen when you do that. So we need to kind of like, we need to be better, or we need to justify it, or we need a reason with it. And it's not that the violence can always be, not always a bad thing, but it's a last resort.
Yeah, it's like cases. It's a tool to be used. I mean, I think that's why I love where Kratos ends up at the end. It's like he's going to become the ruler, or he is like the new ruler of the realm. It's like what Faye sort of sought out for him the whole time. And it is a place for his disciplines to be used to go forward. And he's going to be better, but he's going to help the realm. He's not going to devote it to the wrong thing.
Can we talk about that moment? I want to talk about two things very quickly, if I can. First is the crater area that I've talked about and alluded to previously in this conversation, but specifically Faye's story during that. Like, you never see Faye, Kratos' wife, in the flesh in that section, but you're hearing stories about when she was there last. And I love the story that they spin of her defending this place years ago against a drunk Thor who can't even remember that he fought her at all. In that they have left this frozen lightning bolt, like you leave at the start of the game when you first take on Thor. And I love the story itself, the fact that Faye was, you know, defending this land against these gods long before Kratos had to come and do the same thing. But secondly, that she did all this and more or less kept it to herself. It was something that she didn't reveal to Kratos. And it was a part of her life that, you know, she didn't share. And I love the idea that no matter how close you can be to someone, you don't know everything about them.
Yeah.
You know, there are things that they will keep to themselves, rightly or wrongly, because you can never have, what's that everything everywhere all at once quote, where I think the mother says, like, only give 90% of yourself to someone. Always keep 10% of yourself For yourself. And right. I thought that was kind of reflected in some of these stories where it's like, yeah, we're together, but I, at the end of the day, I am my own person.
Yeah, you're still your agency.
Yeah. I have my own history and it's up to me whether I want to share that. And I think that's reflected a few times. Oh, sorry.
No.
To quickly go into how it's also reflected in Mimir and Sigurd's relationship. Yes. When you do that side mission and Mimir also finds out something about this woman that he was in love with that she didn't share with him, in both Kratos and Mimir get that experience of, oh, these people that we loved and we thought we knew everything about still ultimately were their own people with their own lives before we met them. They existed and did things that they weren't willing to share. Mm. And our whole journey together, if they got a whole journey together, would have been eventually unearthing all of those things. But unfortunately, the time was cut short.
No, that's the thing I love on the side of the face stuff, because she's only in a couple of dream sequences. Memorable because obviously it's Deborah Ann Woll, who I love in Daredevil. And obviously the whole time we've been so curious what Faye looked like and what their history was like. And I like the flashbacks that you get where, like, obviously they're dreams, but then assuming that they are literally what happened, where, like, even Kratos isn't really that bothered that his son's been born. Like, you know, Faye's holding them. Holding Atreus and sort of saying, do you not want to talk to your son? Which even then is a great starting point for his arc as a father. But I just love the way they, like, play that out, which is nicely contrasted against what you find out in the Kratos section, that she wasn't this almost angelic figure. She sort of did have this warrior history to it. It was her axe. And, like, yeah, that she had this sort of, like, big fight that she didn't want to talk about. And Kratos says, I didn't even see that side of her at all. And it's like, yeah, that idea of, like, projecting a certain version of yourself to someone. There's, like, a really old Chris Rock joke about, like, the first time you meet someone, you're meeting their representative, and you'll meet, like, the real them over time. And it's like similar to that. And I feel like that's just, even that is like, Kratos has that, you know, I don't have the monopoly on this relationship in a way. Like, and he's always trying to, like, figure Faye out anyway, and all the different teachings that she left behind. But it almost gives more purpose to everything she set in motion after she died.
And I think it helps him understand Atreus more, because Atreus, a few times in the story, when he has made promises to people to not, like, share their story with Kratos, like, Kratos is like, tell me. And he's like, no, you had secrets. My mom had secrets. Like, I'm allowed to have my own secrets.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Kratos, as he goes through the journey, realizes that that's totally fine. Like, the people sometimes need to have their own things that they don't share, and that's totally cool. But I do like the Faye thing as well, because I think Mimir comments on it that, like, you know, her rage helped destroy this entire valley.
She's almost just as responsible as Thor, 100%, like, to some degree.
Yeah, and I like that. It makes you understand why her and Kratos were together, even if they don't acknowledge that similarity. That similarity was there, that they were these rageful people capable of destruction who were trying to be better and settle down and not be who they used to be. And I was like, that's such a neat connection. And
I think that's a really, like,
I didn't even know they had.
Yeah, I think that's a really lush, like, assumption of what she saw in him as well. Like, it's that whole, because they don't really ask that question. I think Atreus jokes about it. What did mom even see in you?
Yeah.
At one point, because it's one point when Atreus and Mimir, especially when you're exploring Vanaheim, make lots of jokes about how Kratos doesn't say much. Even though I'd say he nearly always has something to say, but whatever. Like, there is that bit, and but it is that general thing of, like, whatever their meeting was like, but, like, Faye does see a similar kind of person in Kratos, like, totally, someone who has battle scars in their eyes. Like, I think that is, like, a really good little wrinkle to their relationship, a relationship that you barely see. It's always just hinted at, especially in the original game. And even this, like I said, you get a couple of dream sequences. But I think that whole idea of, like, doing another game and fleshing stuff out, it's like, is Faye maybe the protagonist? Is that something that they do? Because the thing that Corey Barlog is teasing is that we'll get more Jormungandr stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, that would relate to her if we're doing different points in time. So I think that's fascinating. I think you said you had one more thing.
I was just going to talk about the Sindri characterization.
Adam John
Harrington,
absolute goat.
100%. But we've already talked about this in the video that we did on why the ending is a little bit divisive, so I won't go into it too much. Just other than to say, I love how they depict someone dealing with grief in that situation where this guy is blaming Kratos and Atreus. And yes, it might be a little unjustified, but also, like, he's totally...
It's human, though.
It's human, yeah. You know what I mean? He's totally... It makes sense that he would think that, and you can't be angry at him for thinking that, because he's in this raw situation where he did literally invite all of these strangers into his house. He trusted them, and that got his brother killed, and it might not have been their intent, but it kind of goes back to the theme of intent versus consequence that's talked about at the beginning.
Yep.
It was with good intentions that they were all gathering in that house, but the consequence was they let this snake in who ultimately got their friend and Sindri's brother killed, and of course he's going to be absolutely fuming about that. Of course he's going to hold grudges against Atreus and Kratos for that, because if he just stayed out of all of this, his brother might still be alive. Mm. And I like that there's a complexity to that where it's like, yes, he is reacting aggressively, but you can't fault him for it. And no. I love that Atreus doesn't end things on good terms with him. Like, he tries to apologize, but in that situation, that early on, an apology isn't enough. Like, come back in, like, a month's time, a year's time, where time has allowed it to heal and maybe we'll get somewhere. But right now, words aren't enough.
I'd absolutely love, it's like, there's a lot of good eye acting in this. Yeah. And it's like, there's a lot in, I like that whole, there's that whole thing of, like, you know, I mean, I think I'm thinking of different quotes where people mention like stories being told through someone's eyes, or like how much experience or wisdom is in someone's eyes. And there's a lot of sadness and regret maybe in people's eyes in this, which is an unbelievably human quality to imbue a digital creation with. But look at Kratos' face. Look at his eyes when he's looking at the beam of light when he's in Anaheim the first time. Alfheim, sorry, the first time. Anaheim's a place in Canada or something.
I think it is, yeah.
No, that's not where he was. And when he's in one of the realms, I think they do a lot with that. And there's so much, the way that they just drain the life out of Sindri on that, at that end after Brock passes. Because in himself, you find out that he put Brock's like soul back together. He like found, it was like three or four pieces or something. He didn't finish his fetch quest, but he did as much as he could.
What a brutal end for Brock as well, man. Yeah. He's not only died, he doesn't exist anymore. I hate that little
Oh, because he's already come back and reformed.
Mimir says, like, because he didn't have his full soul, because Sindri only got three of the four pieces, it means that soul in its complete form can't find its way to an afterlife, so it just, he doesn't exist. And I love that in Sindri's characterization, it's not explicitly stated, but he must be feeling some self-loathing for that. The fact that he could only get three of the four pieces, and now when he has died, which he was always going to do, he just doesn't get to move on. He gets to just stop existing. That must be brutal to deal with if you're Sindri.
Yeah, because I think it's really good because you have that general idea of what does death mean in this overall canon. Because in like, it's a weird thing because obviously in the older games, it was just like, well, Kratos is such a badass. He climbs out of hell and just comes back. If you've got enough willpower, you can climb out of death somehow. And they kind of replicate that in this where like certain souls, when they die, go to Niflheim. And like you find the Odin's ravens in the end game, or you find like obviously all the Inner Hajar, or whatever you call the soldier people, platoon of people that are going after you. They're all sort of like reused spirits kind of thing that Odin's brought back. But to then be like, okay, so death means nothing. And it's like, we're doing this whole thing with the prophecy and Ragnarok and everything, but we're all just going to come back anyway, or there's a way for us to come back. But then for them to explain, like, you know, your soul will go to this place and you can wrench parts of that back. It's almost just like a second life thing. But if you die again, you are gone forever and there's nothing.
Yeah.
I think it is good to sort of reinforce the rules of the world in that way and say that like death does matter.
Yes.
Because obviously that's why the life matters so much. And you get that from Brock as well. You get those different things where he's like, you know, people think that I'm dumb, but I'll tell you this riddle, which like, you know, like knocks everyone sideways until the very end, which again, we covered in the other video, but that whole idea of like, what gets bigger than what you take away, is a whole. And that whole idea of that representing the different parts of the characters that are unfulfilled, whether that's like Atreus's purpose or Kratos's emotions or whatever. I think that's incredible. That's incredible writing. Like, and it's threaded through the whole game. And it's just like, it's a hell of an achievement.
It is a hell of an achievement. And like I keep reiterating, man, like I didn't expect it to hit so well on the writing front. And you would be here talking about the lore and you would be talking about Kratos as a dad. But the amount of stuff this game touches on is incredible. Which
we haven't
is
even
why...
talked about the horn.
See, this is...
it doesn't matter.
Oh, this is why the horn don't matter, right?
The horn don't matter at all.
I appreciate that people care a lot about the horn.
I care about the horn, but
totally,
not that much.
That's it. But the reason I don't care about the horn is because when I'm talking about this stuff, the horn don't factor in. The horn doesn't inform any of this stuff, and it's like, it's cool, they could have done more with it, but they don't need to because the thematics is where it's at. And let's end on where Kratos ends in this game, which is the realization that he could be a god that people worship. And I love this Scott Tilford because
I think he thinks of himself as a person, though.
He does.
Yeah.
He 100% does. But at the end, he thinks of himself as a person who can do good and can change things for the better. Whereas in the 2018 game, and even at the start of this game, he doesn't want to because he views himself as someone who can only destroy, and he wants to look after his family, and he doesn't want to be a general because he views being a general in a totally negative light is inflicting pain upon the lands. And we get that great scene with, I think, Heimdall, where Heimdall says, you know, you do not understand even what it means to be a god. Who would worship you? And you know that Kratos absolutely thinks that. Who would worship me? Yeah. I destroyed an entire land. I treated people terribly. I can barely look after my son. So to end up in a situation where he sees the final mural and it's people looking up to him, it's him being an inherently good person and a good influence, not only on his son and his friends, but on all of the realms. Mm. In, like you said earlier, 5 years ago when we started this conversation about like the cracks in the armor, like to get him in that moment where he actually properly breaks down for the first time because he's looking at a reflection of himself that he couldn't have even comprehended at the start of the game. Mm-hmm. What a place to end for this character. And it's so good, I almost hope we never see him again because it's such a good ending for him.
No, man, that's the thing. Like, as much as I like love the gameplay systems and I trust this writing team, and I like the dynamic they have where Corey Barlow kind of took a step, not necessarily back, but above or whatever, to become creative director and let Eric Williams step in as director. I like the idea of almost George Lucasing it and seeing what other teams of people can do with these characters going forward. At the same time, I love where he is now.
Yeah.
And as much as that that mural is obviously painted by Faye, so it's like he has a reflection. Like you said, he breaks down, he has a reflection on his own relationship and everything that he's learned to that point. But it's that general thing of like, is that mural representative of what he immediately walks into? And it's all the realms looking to him to help clean stuff up, because you do get those missions of go clean up the remnants of Asgard that have popped up everywhere, and there's various endgame things that you can play. Or is that a mural of him after he's died? And that's his final endpoint that he's looking at. And he knows in that moment that he will be revered the right way, that his life wasn't wasted, and that like that it will be okay because these murals will always come true to some degree. I think that's a great little interpretation or a wrinkle of that final scene. And he will set off and do the right thing, and you will do that as him for as long as you can until you turn the game off. But like in between when you turn in the game off and that actual mural coming true, that's him finally being revered.
I like that as well, because to be honest, at the end of this game, while he's made the start to unite the realms and while he's done a lot of good, he has a lot of work still to do. There are probably a lot of realms that don't like this guy. Because one, he walked into Alfheim and killed the Dark Elf King in the first game.
There is that.
You know, just annihilated him. Was like,
Freya's gone as well, so there's no... Yeah. No, their little celebrity crush guy, no.
100%. He also did, you know, really do a lot of damage to Asgard, got a whole realm killed, admittedly, you know. Maybe that was the lesser of two evils. What I'm saying is, you know, it's not that he's immediately going to become renowned, but it's what you said. It's the fact that, you know, one day he will be, and more importantly, he believes that one day he will be now, rather than rallying against it or thinking that he can't.
Yeah, and I think it all ties in with that idea of how much of this will come true, which in itself was what the Ragnarok's plot always was. And like that whole thing where he says, you know, fate will only bind you if you let it. And I think like he will do right, and it might line up, but he will do right regardless.
I've just thought of an extra wrinkle to that.
I love the wrinkles.
It's made me love it even more because, yeah, you're right, these murals aren't, you know, they're kind of set in stone, but it's not like people can see the future. You know, the Norns say that your actions are just so predictable, we know where you're going to go.
Yeah.
And I love that Kratos is in a position now where his actions are so predictable, but he's going to be predictably good, if that makes sense. He is on the path now to be doing good things, and those predictable actions aren't going on a rampage and killing people. It's more in character, more predictable for him where he is to ultimately do good in this world.
I think as well, we have our first, as far as I know, we have our first redemptive like icon, like our first like redemptive hero. And there's a whole thing with God of War where it's like, you know, he can't escape the past, and he has the past, and it's not like they're trying to like say, well, that stuff didn't matter, and like the fact that he did kill people. There's people that you kill to solve puzzles in God of War 3, just innocent people. But still, that whole thing of how much mileage is there in redemption, and that's obviously part of his character arc and everything, is just kind of a fascinating reality of where that character is. Like, he'll be one of the faces of PlayStation. Like, he just is. Like, and it's like, but if you play the games and you know the entire span of that character, then part of one of his greatest qualities is believing that that character has some redemption to even view him as a PlayStation icon or something to be looked upon positively.
Yeah.
Like, and how much does that bit at the very end where he breaks down, it's like, does he finally let himself crack for a second to be like, I'm all right, I'm okay. Like, I'm going to be okay.
Yes.
And he's never thought that in 17 years. I'm 17 years in the game out of games.
And you know, for me, in my head canon, why he thinks that, yes, he has been kind of convinced that he can do good, but when Atreus and Kratos reunite, they say that they have been the worst versions of themselves because they don't have each other. Mm. And they vow in the future that when they're alone, they will make a point of hearing the other in their head and thinking about what they are saying. And I think for me, in that moment, when he's looking at the mural of himself, he's probably still thinking, even after all this, like, that can't be me. But in my head, I'm thinking that he's hearing Atreus' voice going like, No, you can't.
Yeah, it is.
You can't. That's you. You can be, I believe that this could be you.
Yeah, I also love just, I mean, we will eventually wrap this pod, but I do love that that scene is just for him. I like that no one else is there. I mean, because Maria's not there. But mainly I like it because it genuinely is just for him. And it's something that Faye, I guess, knew only he would see. And I think that that's just a really good moment. For as much as this has these big ensemble moments and this gigantic overblown fight in for Ragnarok, you can still have a really good grounded character moment for him. And it's great. And obviously you then go back out into the end game and everything. But yeah, overall, God of War Ragnarok, a hell of an achievement.
Good game, man.
Very good game. Good game. IMO. Right. Yeah, not too bad. And the whole fight for game of the year or whatever, like this is grander than that. This is one of those experiences, one of those just pieces of entertainment, pieces of art that you just should go experience, whether it's this year or whatever. It's a great achievement across the board. I have no ending for this other than I love God of War Ragnarok.
Me too. And I loved it more than I expected to, Scott Tilford. And yes, it's not perfect, but what is it? Does it matter when it's this good?
Well, that's exactly what I say about this podcast. So this is the Wind Up Podcast. I've been Scott Tilford. You've been Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you. And we'll catch you next week.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.